The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. It's been a very busy spring for us all, and I want to tell you about some of the things that we've been working on. First off, a reminder that we have 100% free Category 1 CME for docs, APPs, and nurses, and we want to thank our partners at Duke University for supporting us in this endeavor. You can check out our website or our app for more. Second, our student resource is almost complete, and we think it's going to be absolutely huge. The team has been led by Nina Clark and Jessica Millar and our own John McClellan, and they've put together a super practical, high yield, and really nearly comprehensive resource that focuses on how students can dominate their surgery rotation. We've got to-the-point text, original illustrations, all kinds of tables, endless audio, and fantastic video, all of which can be accessed in our app. And the thing that I particularly really like about this is how we decided to focus on student performance and the art and the science of surgery, and less so on rote memorization and shelf preparation, although it will be definitely a good resource for studying for the shelf. We're planning to release this later in the summer. And third, our premium library is growing. So in addition to oral board reviews for general surgery, CT, surgeonc, vascular, and colorectal, we also have the one-of-the-kind trauma surgery video atlas and our AbSight review book. And we are now offering super steep institutional discounts so that you can get your hands on all these resources. And if you're interested, certainly let your program leadership know. Contact us at hello@behindtheknife.org. That again, that's hello@behindtheknife.org. And we can make all that happen. And lastly, our surgical education fellows, Nina Clark, Dan Sheese, and Jessica Millar are leaving us. Pains me to say, they really have been nothing short of amazing. They have worked extremely hard. They've contributed in countless different ways, and they've had huge impact on the projects that we put together. And without a doubt, they have positively impacted the surgical education landscape. So Nina, Dan, and Jessica, we will miss you and are extremely grateful for your contributions to Behind the Knife. You are fantastic human beings and most definitely bound for big things. All right. With that, we can get to the show now. Today, we have another episode of the Big T Trauma Series of Behind the Knife. This series offers clinically oriented material that focuses on how best to care for traumatically injured and critically ill patients. I'm Patrick Georgiev, acute care and trauma surgeon at Duke. And today I'm joined by my former co-fellow, Dr. Teddy Puzio, who is a trauma surgeon at the home of Big T, the University of Texas in Houston. And we have a new guest on the show, Dr. Gabby Hatton, who is currently a second-year fellow, also at the University of Texas in Houston.
It's Patrick. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, yes, yes. Teddy, what's on the docket for today?
Oh, man, we got a good one. But I think as a little lead-in, a little tidbit, before I tell you, I want to offer you this back. Did you know that 6% of patients who go home with an opioid prescription after a procedure will develop opioid dependence? And that a whopping 13% of trauma patients who go home with an opioid prescription will develop opioid dependence?
Yeah. The number is absolutely staggering. 13% of trauma patients who go home with an opioid prescription will develop opioid dependence. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, exactly. Today, we're going to discuss multimodal pain regimen for trauma patients. And while we're focusing on trauma, this is a great topic for all our listeners because really, this applies to all surgical patients.
Yeah, yeah, highly relevant for anyone who cuts to cure. And so, Gabby, not long ago, organizations in the United States were referring to pain as the fifth vital sign. And I can distinctly remember in medical school discharging a few patients after laparoscopic surgery with 50 oxycodone tablets each. And no, I wasn't doing the prescription, but setting up the discharge. And, you know, we've come a really long way since then. So as part of this is the multimodal pain regimen. That's a big key. So what exactly is a multimodal pain regimen?
We really have come a long way. And I would say the simplest definition of a multimodal analgesia regimen is the use of two or more agents that employ different mechanisms for pain management. So medications are given as a bundle. Each of these individual meds target different pain pathways, but together they work synergistically to reduce pain while minimizing harmful side effects. Multimodal regimens have been shown in the literature to improve pain control and reduce opioid use, which are both really great motivators for implementation. Okay. We've been using multimodal pain regimen for over 10 years at UT Houston, thanks to Dr. Alvarado, who implemented the first version of our current multimodal pain regimen. We then evaluated different iterations and medications with multiple randomized trials that have mostly been championed by Dr. Harbin. So I wanted to thank both of them for their hard work on this topic. And I believe it really does make a big difference for patients.
Yeah. And outside of the literature, anecdotally, I have to agree with that for sure, based on my time spent there. And so, Teddy, this is probably an obvious question, but why is pain management so important after trauma? Let's state
that. Yeah, the bottom line is that it's essential for our patients' recovery, right? So they need to be able to get up and move and recover from their injuries. And while opioids they're effective at pain relief, they only target one form of pain receptors, and they come at a cost, which we'll talk about. So in the short term, they can cause, as we know, respiratory depression, excessive sedation, nausea, vomiting, urinary retention, constipation, goes on and on. But in the long term, it's devastating, right? Again, as I said, 6% of patients who go home with an opioid prescription after a procedure will develop opioid dependence. And 13% of trauma patients will have dependence. In fact, 75% of heroin users were introduced to opioids via prescription medications. And this is something that's all over the news. There's Netflix specials, there's documentaries. If you have watched the news at all in the last year or so, you will agree that the United States is facing a terrible opioid epidemic, and that has ruined countless lives.
Yeah, I recently watched it was a very well done documentary on Netflix, and I kind of was struck by the fact that we, as healers, people who are trying to help someone, that writing these opioid prescriptions, among other providers too, but surgeons are, again, cut to heal, have played such a large role, at least historically, in this really devastating problem. But it's also heartening to see that surgeons are playing a role in trying to get ahead of this too.
Yeah, it's really devastating. And that's where we can make an impact with the multimodal approach, and we can use it to help limit opioid use. So the foundation of a multimodal pain regimen are oral medications that focus on several different pain receptors. We schedule the core medications around the clock as standing orders, and they include, at our institution, Tylenol, NSAIDs, which are COX inhibitors, and gabapentin, or pregabalin, which crosses the blood-brain barrier to act on neurotransmitters. We also include scheduled lidoderm patches, which is a topical anesthetic. Most patients are also offered a low-dose, as-needed opioid as well. And all patients are given this PO regimen unless their bowel is in discontinuity. So really, everybody is given the core regimen as long as they have their bowel hooked back after the surgery.
I imagine that regimen sounds a little wild to some providers, some people, some listeners who have never really used multimodal. I know for me, the first time when I came here as a fellow, I'd never experienced this before. But the regimen is very, very effective at reducing post-traumatic and surgical pain.
I've observed this as well. I think people do really well on it. But there also are a number of adjuncts that we can use to supplement the traditional core multimodal regimen. We sometimes apply a muscle relaxer such as Robaxin if a patient is describing specifically muscle spasms. And this is common with our long bone fractures that aren't reduced, or bent pelvis fractures. We might also request a regional block by anesthesia for extremity injuries, rib fractures, incisional pain, which are really great and effective. And we like to call our APMS team for those. And finally, we have been utilizing ketamine drips or lidocaine drips if a patient is monitored in a monitored unit or in the ICU.
Yeah, just to give a little shout out to ketamine, one of my partners, Dr. John Harbin, just completed a randomized controlled trial actually looking at ketamine infusions in addition to our multimodal regimen. And he found that this addition to the multimodal regimen that we were already using was an effective means to reduce daily opioid requirements in hospitalized patients with severe injuries. We're going to put a link to this article and have several others that we're discussing in the show notes.
One thing we should point out that despite the multimodal regimen being standardized for all of our patients, each of these medications are their own contraindications and might not be appropriate for each and every patient. So while we have so many tools at our disposal, that is fantastic, but we can really tailor the regimen to each individual patient based on the risks and benefits of each medication.
Yeah, I think it's worth probably talking about a few of these, and we have to start with one that gets people real fired up, which is NSAIDs. And the fireworks really start to fly when there's talk of bony non-union and bleeding and anastomotic leaks when you get some TORD also. Teddy, let's start off with bone non-union. So in 2020, just recently, EASE published a practice management guideline looking at the efficacy and safety of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Toradol for the treatment of acute pain after orthopedic trauma. So what did they find?
So yeah, that's a good one to bring up. So the authors offered a conditional recommendation to use NSAIDs in adult patients with fractures. Careful if there's any orthopods out there that might take offense to this, but despite red water, the evidence still found that most studies show no association between NSAIDs and bone non-union, and there was a clear impact on reduction of acute pain and use of opioids.
Right. Okay, so no clear evidence of bony non-union with the use of NSAIDs. Another big concern specifically with NSAIDs is post-operative bleeding. Big one.
Yeah, this
trauma patient.
That's right. The anesthesiologists, they always ask us at the end of the case, is it okay to give Toradol because of a bleeding risk? But there was a systematic review and meta-analysis in Jackson 2021 addressing this problem. They looked at 74 different studies using data from over 150,000 patients who underwent a really wide range of procedures, ENT, breast, abdominal surgery, plastics, and found no difference in hematoma formation, return to OR, bleeding, or need for blood transfusion between patients receiving NSAIDs and those who didn't.
Yeah, that's a pretty reasonable study to look at. They did a really nice job. And I'm always...
You got to bring something for the bleeding, though, right?
I mean, I'm always blaming, like, you know, there's someone in pain. We got some multimodal goodness going. The patients are still hurting. And you look at their med list on rounds, and there's no Motrin, there's no Toradol to be found. And I ask the team, why can't we be on an NSAID? And like, well, this patient's at risk of bleeding. And you look farther down the list and the patient's on. Drumroll, Teddy. Lovenox. So it's always kind of blows. We're out of blood thinner. And the main rationale for not being able to give NSAIDs in these traumatically injured patients is bleeding. So that really doesn't add up if we've gotten to the point where we know that patient is safe enough to be receiving DVT chemo prophylaxis.
Yeah, but I think this goes back to, I mean, sadly, a lot of medicine is dogma, right? You know what you were taught, and unless you're aware of things and you are a critical thinker and you look in the literature, you're just going to do what you have always done. And I think that's where NSAIDs get a bad rap, right?
Yeah.
That, why does anesthesia ask you if you want it? I mean, they make you think like, oh, it might do something bad. And if you don't know the literature, you might be hesitant.
Yeah. Man, now speaking of knowing the literature, though, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, right? So what about anastomotic leaks then, Teddy?
Okay, so another contentious point. Ultimately, though, we don't know if NSAIDs like Toradol increase anastomotic leak, as the data is kind of mixed. There is a signal, but it isn't a very big one. We actually studied this here at UT and found that trauma patients who underwent resection and anastomosis may actually have a higher risk of leak when given NSAIDs. And again, that paper's in the show notes that there was a higher odds ratio. But other risk factors like vasopressors and blood transfusions and were much higher risk factors than this.
Right. So if NSAIDs, in fact, are opioid-sparing, if they do really help with pain control, these other benefits obviously need to be considered in the setting of their risks. And two things we do know for sure, though, and have to state, is that NSAIDs can definitely cause kidney injury based on their mechanism of action, and they can lead also to peptic ulceration if you use it heavily or for a long period of time. So these are two proven side effects and definitely need to be considered when using NSAID. So let's move on next to, let's do gabapentin. So Gabby, how does gabapentin actually work?
Sure. So meta-analyses have demonstrated that gabapentin improves postoperative pain when it's used as a part of a multimodal regimen. However, the medication is associated with sedation. So particularly elderly patients are pretty vulnerable to the side effect. So we should consider giving them a lower dose or avoiding gabapentinoids altogether in those patients. And the dose should probably be reduced in patients with poor renal function, usually from 300 every 8 hours to 100 every 8 hours.
And Gabby, you mentioned earlier that these are like generalizations for all patients. We should really tailor these for specific patients, right? And I think the patients that do very well with gabapentin and its sibling pregabalin, aka Lyrica, are the patients that have true neuropathic nerve pain.
So let's move on to muscle relaxers. Do these actually help? Teddy?
So again, as part of a multimodal pain regimen, yes. Individual use of muscle relaxers and in the trauma setting, you don't really know. There is some decent data showing that short-term use of muscle relaxers can help people with lower back pain, but in the trauma world, limited to trauma patients today is pretty minimal. And again, we kind of specifically target patients that describe spastic pain. We don't just across the board give it to everyone.
Yeah. And so when you talk about bundling this stuff, yeah, this reminds me of like the sepsis avoidance bundle for colorectal surgery, where there's all types of things you're doing in terms of antibiotics and prep and wound protectors and glove changes and all those kinds of things. And we know that the bundle works well together to reduce surgical site infections, but we don't know exactly which pieces of the bundle are playing the biggest role. And to some degree, that's kind of similar with multimodal pain, although we do know that we are, as I mentioned in the beginning, trying to target as many different pathways as possible with the primary goal of providing good pain control and using all the options at our disposal, but tailoring it to the individual patient while also decreasing opioid use. We should mention, like gabapentin, the muscle relaxers can also be sedating as well. So I'm going to put in this Toradol order really quick, Gabby, before we continue on here. Okay, 15 or 30, guys, what's it going to be?
What's 30, your
for
sure. 30? Okay. The baby at home.
Gabby.
No, how many anastomosis do they have?
But... That's right. So we should talk, when it comes to pain, we can't just talk about giving meds, right? A huge component of pain control, and really maybe the biggest component, really has nothing to do with medications. And it's a lot about communicating clearly with patients and setting expectations and using shared decision-making. Because in the end, pain is truly multidimensional. And it's a sensory experiences, and patients' response to pain, as we all have seen, can vary extremely widely based on so many different factors.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important to point out that partnership with our patients is essential to reach our mutual goals. This is not elective surgery where we can talk to them before and let them know what they're going to expect, right, as far as pain control. But we have to reach that understanding quickly in their hospital course. And it's important to remind them that pain after trauma is normal. We can't make it all go away, but we should establish goals for pain management early and then introduce this multimodal regimen, right? Help them understand why they're getting pain meds around the clock and why they're getting Tylenol when it doesn't work for them for different things. And then we have to help them understand that they all kind of work together. And trauma is a team sport. We'll say that all the time. And it's not just the physicians. I think it's important that the nurses are part of this too, right? We're all in this together.
Occasionally, though, we do get patients and families who would expect to be sedated or completely pain-free after injury. But usually a more in-depth conversation clears this up because these expectations just don't align with recovery. So there's excellent research on the basic science literature that opioids actually cause hyperalgesia, where opioids will acutely improve pain. Over the subsequent days and weeks, pain is actually increased, and then the duration of pain is nearly double in duration when compared to a placebo. So ultimately, there are lots of reasons to try everything else first.
I think it's also important that we talk about de-escalation, right? As a resident, I don't remember learning or thinking about this, but it's a huge part of what we do. Literally every day we talk about de-escalation. As patients progress through the hospital stay, they are evaluated for ongoing pain medication needs with the aims to first adequately manage their pain and then wean off all opioids. So literally every day we look at their medication requirements in every single patient. And it's it's kind of funny to practice in the mirror when the residents just know this is the norm, right? They don't know any different, right? Patrick, I bet when you would agree that learning to wean pain medications was just not a thing. Like, did you learn that in the residency?
No, but now, again, this is as part of the team approach to trauma, and then as part of rounds, it's a daily thought, just like advancing a diet and getting off oxygen. Can you get rid of opioids? Getting that patient back to normal as quickly as possible so we can get them out of the hospital. I think going back to expectation setting, it really is incredible how effective this is and how effective it is to normalize not using opioids following surgery or injury. It's easiest to see this in an elective practice where you have the chance to set the stage for postoperative pain management in the clinic before the surgery even happens. And then you can see your plan through in collaboration with your patient after surgery. And if you haven't set up and explain very clearly what to expect and the fact that you will be in pain, and for them to understand and be able to cope with that, how long that pain may last, how severe you think it might be. While everyone is different, most folks do fall in somewhere in that middle of the spectrum. And when they are able to rationalize it in advance, it's amazing how much better they are able to tolerate pain moving forward here. And this is a little bit of a side note, I think, but certainly relevant. It's amazing also to me to observe how pain is thought about and how pain is managed in different settings. And specifically what I'm thinking about is low resource environments where opioids aren't quite as readily available as they are in the United States, or they're simply not used for a variety of different reasons. And the culture surrounding pain in these environments is remarkably different than what we have here in the United States. Now, I'm not the one with a laparotomy incision, so far be it from me to draw conclusions or make any, you know, assumptions about people being in real pain and suffering, but it's just remarkable how different that entire environment is and how setting expectations can really change a patient's approach to their pain after surgery or injury.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Patrick. I think another great example is what the use of opioid PCOs, right? It's funny to think about it, but I've been here at UT for almost 6 years. And any given year we see, last year we had close to 11,000 trauma patients in our visiting total. And I have not seen a single PCA for trauma patients. I kid you not. It's just, it's essentially...
You've been there for 6 years of not seeing a single PCA in a trauma.
It is a never event for our service. It just never happens. And I just think that it speaks to the culture of pain management, right? Like, we are really sensitive to the fact that, as I said in the beginning, risk opioid dependence, we are a huge part of this problem. And if we don't try to reduce opioids, it's going to just get worse and worse.
I think a lot of people are questioning if that's real, if that's true. How can 6 years at the nation's busiest trauma center and not see a single patient on an opioid PCA? I saw that culture as well, so I do know.
Yeah, exactly. You were back
with it. But I can hear like the collective groan from the pain services. It's like, oh, this is BS, like rolling over, thinking how bogus this is. But again, I think that is around the culture mostly in terms of expectation setting and then providing that multimodal regimen, which can certainly include IV narcotics as well, if needed.
Yeah.
How about discharge then, Gabby? Do you have a protocol for the patient going home after a traumatic injury who was on a multimodal regimen in-house?
Yeah, so our discharge protocol provides prescriptions using essentially the same regimen that a patient is on as an inpatient. So while they're changing their physical setting, we're trying to continue as much of what they're on as in the hospital as when they go home, at least for the first couple of days. So we supply 3 to 4 weeks of a non-opioid medication and about 5 days of an opioid medication if they're still actively being used. And we're still prescribing about 50% of our patients an opioid at discharge. So there's still room for improvement in our institution as well.
Yeah. And so that's still a lot of people go home with some opioids, and I think much, much, much less than in decades prior. And we should probably mention that to reduce opioids in the community, it's good practice to have patients bring their unused opioids to their clinic appointment, or to recommend very clearly a safe disposal area, such as a pharmacy that you know will take and dispose of opioids. That's a big deal. And I think I've seen some communities do it much better than others. But if you don't have that resource, you can poke around a little bit and very quickly find it, again, in most settings. So, Teddy, as we wrap up, do you have any recommendations for implementing this opioid-sparing multimodal pain approach at an institution that may not be using it right now?
Ah, yes. Funny you should ask, Patrick. I think as in so much of the world of trauma and surgery, guidelines are an excellent tool to aid in implementation, right? But it's not just here's the guideline, figure it out. You have to get buy-in from everyone, right? You have to get buy-in from everyone that is involved in the care of these patients. Because if your nurses are setting expectations with patients that they're going to get IV dilaudid, it doesn't matter what the guideline says, right? It creates strife. So sit down, talk to the people at your hospital, talk to other centers, look at guidelines that are available. We have all of ours published online, and get the stakeholders at your center to agree and then create a guideline and try to follow it.
Yeah. And like so much in the world of trauma, and frankly, if you look back at the trauma episodes we've done as part of this series, it really is all about rolling up, you know, your sleeves, putting a little elbow grease in and working the room, working the institution, getting the right stakeholders involved, getting people involved. Because in the end, you're not talking about anything too challenging here, right? You got to slog through an epic order set build, et cetera, but you're talking Tylenol and Motrin and gabapentin. These are all medications everyone's used to and everyone's on board with reducing opioids. So it's not that mind-blowing in terms of trying to implement it, but the work to do so is extraordinarily challenging, just like any other kind of major initiative or change. And really, in the end, guidelines, when it's written down after consensus building, is the best way to go about it. So one thing we're not going to have time to talk about today is regional pain control. We're actually going to work on another episode for that, between things like QL blocks and rectus sheath and all these other different approaches to regional pain control. And that includes trauma patients, rib fractures, serratus blocks, all those things. We're going to do another episode on that and get some anesthesia friends on to help explain what that's going on. But with that said, what, Gabby, is on the horizon when it comes to the work that you and your partners at UT have done when it comes to multimodal pain control?
Yeah, definitely. There is an ongoing study at our center actually evaluating the effects of dronabinol when added to the multimodal pain regimen. And we're really eager to hear the results of that. I personally have seen it be very effective for our trauma patients.
I look forward to seeing that too. That'd be something new for someone like myself. So it could be an exciting addition perhaps, or another a tool in your armamentarium to treat hard to control pain.
All right, as we wrap up, I think it's important to point out another important resource to all our listeners. So the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma has published a best practice guidelines for pain management in trauma patients. I think everyone that's interested in this should take a look at this document. It goes into a lot more detail than what we went into, and it really covers other modalities that we didn't even really touch on. So it's a good resource to know about.
Yeah, it's a great resource to personally just kind of look at and save as a PDF on your, you know, computer, phone, et cetera. But also when it comes to if you're going to work on guidelines and order sets and all that, it's got very specific information about which meds, doses, et cetera. And Teddy, like you said, it does go beyond and compiles the data for things that aren't used quite as often. So with that, we'll wrap up our discussion of multimodal pain control. And until next time, Gabby.
Don't hide the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.